A few minutes later, the big steel door on the side of the building rolled up, and with a deep, lusty mechanical roar, an automobile catapulted out of the warehouse and up the street. It was a low-slung and compact, white and scarlet roadster, with a long, bulging fendered hood, two glaring round headlamps flanking a recessed oval grille like a jet intake, and an abbreviated trunk behind a cramped passenger compartment that could seat four, as long as the two in the back didn't mind sitting with their knees pressed tightly together, facing each other. Corwin, his hair whipped from disorder into complete confusion by the slipstream, grinned a great bug-catching grin as he slung the machine onto the ramp and up onto Highway 6A, the central bypass to the loop road that encircled the Golden City.
"This is the CX-68, huh?"
Utina called to him over the roar of the engine. Her own hair was pulled out behind her in a great pink streamer, and though she knew she'd have to do some brushing before dinner if she didn't want to look completely scruffy, she didn't mind it. The cool wind felt too good, too free, after her brush with mortality in a small, dark room the day before.
"This is it," Corwin replied, shifting gears. "Mom built her in 2246 for the Nakomi Motor Club for a vintage-themed road race. It was called The Greatest Cars That Never Were."
He shifted again, settling into a comfortable cruising speed as the slightly banked highway curved up to meet them, road lamp pylons whipping past with a rhythmic sound.
"This is a 1968 AC Cobra 2+2, he told her.
Utina looked over her shoulder at the pair of jump seats, then understood and grinned.
"The classic Cobras were two-seaters," she said. "Your Uncle Keiichi taught me that."
"Exactly," Corwin replied. "The idea was to build a car that some great 20th century manufacturer never made, but could have if they'd thought of it." One of the other teams brought a 1995 Stanley Steamer, fastest steam-powered land vehicle in history. That was a slick rig. Even Mom was impressed. They barreled up the highway in a companionable silence after that, the sound of the slipstream and the roar of the 427-inch engine making it necessary to shout to be heard anyway. Corwin took 6A out to the loop road itself, Highway 6, then rode that halfway around the city before jumping off onto Highway 91, which, according to the big green sign at the interchange, would eventually take them to Alfheim. They weren't going that far, though. After only a few miles northward, Corwin pulled off at an exit and followed a twisty, narrow track up the side of a hill, with much relishing of gear changes. Presently, they pulled through a thicket of tall pine trees and into a guardrail parking area, and spread out ahead of them, in a panoramic vista that took up the whole horizon, was Asgard. As the CX-68 came to a halt, Utina put her hands on the windshield frame and stood up in her seat, her face lit with undisguised, delighted awe at the fully revealed grandeur of the seat of the gods. From where she'd been looking before, she couldn't see its most impressive feature because she'd been using it for her vantage point. Odin's palace, greatest of the castles of Asgard, rising up out of the center of the city in a great cascade of towers. It was as much modern skyscraper as medieval castle. There was something art deco, streamlined and self-consciously futuristic about its setbacks and crenellations. And yet its great central bulk spoke of fortifications ancient when the world was new. From its tallest central spire, a beam of light, bright enough to be plainly visible now in broad summer daylight, thrust brilliantly into the clear blue sky.
"Wow," said Utina.
Corwin mirrored her position in his own seat, grinning. "Gives you a chill, doesn't it? I've seen it hundreds of times, and I still feel it."
"What's that light?"
"The beacon of creation," Corwin replied. "It's burned since Mom and the others restarted the world engine after the Ragnarok. Part of the new program to make sure such a thing can never happen again. Even in the worst, darkest storms, it burns a hole through the clouds to reach the sky. But in the dark, it doesn't cast light. It just is light. Which makes the court astronomers happy," he added with a wry grin. "Can you imagine the light pollution if that was a beam of normal light that size?"
"Yeah, no kidding," Utina chuckled.
They had a picnic lunch sitting on the warm hood of the softly pinging Cobra. Big, substantial sandwiches put together by someone on Odin's kitchen staff, chips, and cans of an odd beverage that was sort of a cross between root beer and what gold might taste like if it were edible. Then sat back against the windshield for a while and watched the air traffic over the Golden City flit here and there on inscrutable errands. They didn't speak or even particularly think. They just sat there, enjoyed being alive, being safe, and being together. Corwin had his hands behind his head, legs crossed at the ankles, stretched out full length on the hood of the car. For a few minutes, he looked like he might have dozed off. Ibsen leaned on her elbow and just watched him for a minute, trying to memorize every line of his face now that the pain and worry were erased from it. She didn't often see him in complete repose like this. Even when idle, he was usually thinking about something, bringing out the faint lines on his forehead and between his eyes. Presently, he seemed to feel her gaze on him, and opened one eye curiously. "Copper for your thoughts," he said.
"I was just thinking," she said quietly, "how lucky I am that I didn't lose you yesterday."
He smiled, sat up, and patted her free hand.
"Me too," he replied, the seriousness in his tone and his eyes putting the lie to the lightness of the words.
Then, just when the moment threatened to get maudlin, Corwin said lightly, "Well, I guess we'd better go see what Lyneth wants to show us." He got down from the hood, moved toward the driver's door, then thought better of it, put his hand on the driver's roll bar, and vaulted the center console into the passenger seat.
"Kiana said to take it easy on my hands," he said with a pious smile.
Utina grinned and hopped over the door into the driver's seat, adjusted it back a bit to account for her longer legs, fiddled with the mirrors, then fired the Cobra up and aimed it for the city. She discovered immediately that there had been a very good reason for Corwin's uncontrolled grin on their way up here. It was impossible to drive this car without grinning like that, if you like your cars fast, agile, and noisy. It was a different experience from Uncle Keiichi's well-mannered Lancer Evo 3X, or Corwin's refined Griffin limousine. This car was all business and no manners to speak of, just horsepower, traction, and razor-sharp close-ratio steering. Just getting it down to the highway was an exhilarating adventure, to say nothing of opening it up when they got there. They reached the spaceport, navigating by the big green signs and the occasional frantic hand signal, in a little less than 10 minutes.
"When I get a car of my own," said Utina to herself as they left the Cobra pinging by the curb and headed into the spaceport concourse, "God willing, it'll be a car like that."
Lyneth, the Valkyrie mechanic, was a slim creature with big blue eyes and pale gold hair. She was dressed in a smudged gray coverall like the ones Corwin usually wore to work on cars and spacecraft, and she was brisk and businesslike as she led them to the revetment where the Kanduskeg sat, its dorsal surface dismantled to allow Lyneth and her technicians access to the warp core and fuel tankage beneath.
"The explosion in the primary deuterium tank that crippled your runabout," she told them, pointing at the mangled section of the overhead equipment bay where the tank had been, "seems to have been caused by a mechanical defect in the tank itself, probably a metal flaw in the pressure neck. Unfortunately, you jettisoned the tank, so we'll probably never know for sure, but I hadn't found any sign of sabotage. No explosive residue, nothing that might account for such a catastrophic failure. If I had to guess, and I do, I'd say it was a manufacturing defect."
Corwin nodded. "I figured. It had to be either that or an impact through one of the micro-gaps in the navigational deflector fields."
"I can't rule that out entirely," Lyneth replied, "but there's no sign of any foreign object, even on the atomic level, and of the two occurrences, a flaw in the tank is a lot more likely."
She cocked her head. "Looks like you just got star-crossed."
"Looks like it," said Corwin, nodding again.
"Fortunately, I had a countercharm on board," he added, grinning at Utina, who put her hands behind her head and did her best to look innocent.
"So Kiana tells me," said Lyneth with a calm smile.
"How long until she's spaceworthy again?" Corwin wondered.
"Well," Lyneth replied, her sea-blue eyes twinkling, "Kiana says you need to take it easy for 5 days in order to fully recover from your adventure, so..."
"5 days," said Corwin. Lyneth winked.
"You're a clever boy," she said. "I might almost believe you are Skuld's son."
"So," said Utina after they'd stopped by Corwin's apartment, parked the CX-68 out front, and were walking back toward Odin's palace in the gathering afternoon shadows.
"So," Corwin replied.
"Are all the women you grew up hanging around with gorgeous like that?"
"Huh?
Oh, yeah, I guess so, if you say so." Then he gave her a sly look and said, "I thought you weren't into that kind of thing most of the time."
"I'm not," she replied, giving him a don't you start look. "I'm just making an observation. I mean, counting your mother, I've seen 4 Valkyrie now, and they're all these spectacularly beautiful women. I'm not blind."
Corwin shrugged.
"Maybe I'm just used to them. Besides, are you counting V in that list?"
"Well, yeah," said Utina. "Did you ever actually look at her? She's like a little miniature jury, except for the freckles."
Corwin gave her a weird look. Okay, he replied. I think maybe we'd better step lively getting to dinner. Low blood sugar is obviously interfering with your mental processes. She hit him on the shoulder. Utna Tenjo was not a person easily intimidated, but the Great Hall of Asgard was a pretty intimidating setting. It was about the size of the ballroom back at Otori Academy, except with a higher ceiling and totally different decor. Heavy rafters of smoke-darkened wood, stone walls studded with fireplaces and torch sconces, and a great long pair of trestle tables, one along each side of the big rectangular room, were the key features. Up at the end of the room there was a raised dais like a stage. In front of this was another shorter table set crossways across the room. Tonight, this was the only table with anyone sitting at it. Corwin, dressed in his black and silver Valkyrie dress uniform, introduced Utna, who had brushed her hair glossy and summoned the Rose Knight embellishments to her Otori uniform, to the Council of the Aesir, Asgard's ruling body. Despite its name, not all the gods on it were Aesir. Frey and Freya Lightwalker were Vanir, and nobody really knew quite what Peirith Charmsinger was, except possibly Odin. Odin Winterbeard, ruler of the gods, reminded Utna of a department store Santa Claus, except that his gray clothes and eye patch made him look like Santa dressed as a pirate. He was jolly like Santa, though, and seemed bent on making his guest feel at home, despite the fact that she was surrounded by fully-fledged divinities who were old when Corwin's immortal father was centuries yet to be born. This isn't a formal dinner, he assured her, nodding her to her seat between Corwin and an empty chair. If it were, he added dryly, I'd be a bit wroth at the one who's decided to be late. Keep your shirt on, Pop, came a familiar voice from the great doors leading into the hall. I'm here. And so she was. Taking her seat on Utna's right, a big, unsettlingly open-looking smile on her face, was Corwin's Aunt Erd. Erd was a tall woman, and like all the other women of Asgard Utna had met, she was startlingly beautiful. She was different from most Asgardian women, though. The women among the Aesir and Vanir tended to be fair-skinned, in some cases, Vigdis Brightblade, for instance, almost outright white. Vigdis's near-transparent skin made Utna's own milky complexion look positively ruddy by comparison. She was an extreme example, being a flaming redhead, but still, the women of Asgard tended to be pale in Utna's experience. Not Erd, though. Her skin was a dark copper color, almost the same as that of Utna's Dantrovian friend, Azalin Dvir Natashkin. Her wavy snow-white hair made her look even darker. The lines of her face, though they bore a family resemblance to her sisters, Vertandi and Corwin's mother Skuld, had a difference about them, a sort of angular felinity that was accentuated by her slightly slanted devil-green eyes. Erd was, in appearance at least, a breed apart, and she carried herself so as to leave no doubt that she quite well knew it. As a matter of fact, now that Utna looked at her in this light, dressed in the formal robes of the Asgardian court, Erd looked a little like Eumemia. I think, Utna told herself ruefully, that has more to do with how much you miss Eumemia than what Erd actually looks like. Next you'll be seeing her in mirrors. At the thought, she glanced reflexively at the shiny surface of her butterknife, but there was only her own reflection there tonight. Something wrong with your knife? Corwin murmured. Huh? Oh, no, it's fine, Utna replied, putting down the knife and feeling faintly silly. Meanwhile, in the face of Odin's continued slightly grumpy look, the dusky goddess smiled and said, Okay, okay, I'm sorry I'm late. I was working in my lab and lost track of the time. Odin tried to glower at his most wayward daughter for a few more moments, gave up, and relented with a faint smile. Very well, he rumbled. I believe you already know Miss Tenjo. Sure I do, said Erd with a grin. How you been, kid? I hear you had a little bit of an adventure yesterday, you and Captain Excitement here. No big deal, Utna replied. Just some mechanical problems. Erd nodded, winking one of her emerald eyes. Sure, she said, and clapped Utna on the shoulder, making her epaulette chain jingle. Dinner, despite Corwin's creeping dread of his aunt, went quite well. The food, as befitted the Allfather's kitchen, was excellent, and not as basic as Utna had been expecting from the table of the Norse gods. The main course tonight was a sweet sausage lasagna that was just to die for. She made a mental note to try and get the recipe. Unlike last year's dorm, the duelist's castle on Gerardo had, or would have when the duelists were done remodeling it, a kitchen, so at long last she would be able to cook her own food instead of being at the mercy of a school's indifferent meal plan.
"Mmm," said Corwin. "Null would kill for this lasagna."
"Where is your draconic companion this day, Corwin?" asked Thor.
"Tomodachi," Corwin replied. "He claims he doesn't like warp drive, but I think it was because if he'd come along for this particular practical, he'd have missed Aunt Belle's chicken stew tomorrow night."
That sent a laugh around the table. It was apparently well known among the gods that Corwin's boon companion was a Class A chowhound. At the meal's end, the gods got up one by one, excused themselves, and said it had been a pleasure meeting Utina. To Corwin's infinite relief, not one of them had called her anything like Ravenhair's young lady, of which he had been going in dread all through the meal. It was just the sort of thing that, for example, Frey would say. When the others were all gone, Odin got up from his seat and said in a formalish tone,
"Grandson, I would speak with you for a few moments in my study."
Corwin, recognizing the tone, got to his feet, bowed, and said,
"As you please, Allfather."
Smiling at Utina, Odin went on,
"Worry not, I won't keep him long."
And then the two of them left the great hall through a side door, leaving Utina alone with Urd. Urd watched them go, waited for the door to close, then grinned and hopped up on the stage, facing Utina.
"A little bird told me," she said, "that you had a little more than some mechanical problems."
"Way I heard it, Captain Excitement just about signed himself into the Book of the Dead, and you went and got him back."
"I don't know if I'd go that far," Utina replied. "I mean, you make it sound like some kind of miracle or something. All I did was what they taught me to do in school, and..."
She paused.
"And it barely worked," she went on after a moment. "I almost lost him."
Urd looked around, as though to make certain they were really alone, then alighted from the stage, spun the chair next to Utina around, and sat down on it with her arms crossed over the top of the back.
"Kiana didn't want to lay this on you in so many words," said the Norn of Memory, "but I think it's important that you know. Newsflash, sister. For a second, you did lose him. Haven't you noticed that the circle on his forehead's broken? His pattern had started to detach from the celestial system. When an ace by blood dies who hasn't passed his trial, there's no afterlife for him," she explained. "He just comes apart. All that makes him who and what he is dissipates into the universe. No trip across the river, no chance to march in the armies of either side on the final day. Just oblivion. It's why failing the trial exacts the ultimate price."
"What are you saying?" asked Utina, somewhere between puzzled and belligerent. "The Corwin did die? If that's the case, then how is he here?" A horrible thought struck her then, seizing her heart in a grip of ice, as she remembered something the ghost of Dios had told her on a balcony in Toronto. "I died, and my body kept going without me." Urd saw the color drain from Utina's face and reached to take hold of her hand.
"No, no, don't worry," she said, her green eyes intense. "That's what makes it a miracle. You understand? He'd started to dissipate, and you brought him back. Pulled the essence of him back together and bound it back to his body where it belongs. That's something even I can't do. Maybe, just maybe, all three of us, me, Bell, and Skuld, we could make something like that happen. Maybe. And then again, maybe not."
Utina gazed into the uncharacteristically serious face of Corwin's aunt for a few moments, trying to grasp what she'd just been told.
What does that mean?" she finally asked, her voice hushed.
"I'm not sure," Urd replied honestly. "It's unique in my experience. I'm sure it has something to do with the power inside you, the one Beldandi helped you seal. But more than that, it's a measure of the bond between you. You just refused to let him die. And you felt it so strongly that it mastered your sealed power. And so..."
Urd spread her hands, palms up.
"Voila!"
The two women sat in silence for a few moments, regarding each other thoughtfully in the flickering torchlight.
"So," said Utina in a small voice, "what now?"
Urd shrugged. "Who can say? My bailiwick is the past, not the future. Oh, I've been known to involve myself in a travail of the heart or two.
she added with a wry grin. I am the goddess of love. But, just as quickly, she became serious again, more serious than Utina had ever seen her, and she went on, I have sworn an oath on my own blood not to interfere with you. Skuld feels that strongly about it that she doesn't even want me joking about it. And I think she's right. So, for once in the cycle of the cosmos, we agreed. If an Ace ever swears something to you on his blood, she told Utina sternly, he'll die before he breaks that oath deliberately. Utina nodded. How much do you know about me? Enough, Erd replied enigmatically. She got to her feet. Listen, I'd better go. I might have said too much already, but I don't think so. I think I'm still in good faith. I just wanted you to know how special what you did is, and to think about why you did it. That's all. Where you go from there is up to you. Utina, though a bit confused, smiled gamely. Well, thanks, she said. Thank you, said Erd. And hey, tell Corwin to quit cringing whenever he sees me coming, will you? His mother doesn't want him to know she swore me to blood to keep me out of his hair, but you might at least hint that I'm trying to behave myself, she said with a grin. Utina grinned back and said, I'll see what I can do. Thanks. Well, see you around, Utina. Bye, said Utina, and Erd left the great hall, leaving the duelist alone with her thoughts. She wasn't sure how much later the other door reopened, and Corwin emerged. He looked as though something heavy had been put on his mind. He gave her a sort of distracted hello and led the way vaguely out through another of the side doors into a corridor. Problem? Asked Utina. Hmm? Oh, sorry, said Corwin. I was just thinking. Granddad just told me the counselor's starting to plan my trial. He thinks they'll be ready to call me sometime in the next 6 to 8 months. Oh. Well, that's good news, isn't it? In a way, Corwin replied. It's pretty heavy news either way. Any idea what it'll be? No, said Corwin. He stopped before a tall, heavy, iron-banded door. Instead of producing a key to use in the big, old-fashioned cast-iron lock, he closed his eyes in concentration for a moment. A ball of white light sprang into existence in the palm of his left hand. He placed that light to the keyhole, which seemed almost to suck it in, and there was a great clunk from within the door before it swung slowly, silently open. "Come on," he said softly. "I want to show you something."